Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, scumbags. This is the Scummy Mummies podcast with your hosts, Ellie Gibson and Helen Thorne.
Hello and welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. I'm Ellie Gibson.
And I'm Helen Thorne.
And our guest today is the amazing Lisa Jewell. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Do I sound overexcited?
You really do, particularly for a Monday morning.
I'm very overexcited. I've been trying to be cool while I've been setting up, but I'm actually really excited because I've been a big fan for a long time, Lisa. And I don't always say that to the guests, do I, Helen?
No, you've never said that to me.
No, sometimes I actively dislike them. But no, I'm very, very excited to meet you. But I tell you what, for the listener, how would you describe yourself?
How would I describe myself? I would describe myself as a writer with a very, very long career that started in the late 90s and is still blossoming now.
Even now when you say a long career that started in the late 90s, yeah. I'm like, was that a long time ago?
No, it wasn't 15 years ago, I'm afraid. I know it feels like it was, but yeah. Yeah, and I started off writing romantic comedies, and I've morphed and evolved over the years into writing incredibly dark, twisted, sinister psychological thrillers. Yeah, so that's me.
So it all began with a book called Ralph's Party, yes. Which I remember, like everybody I knew... Yep. Read that book, like all women in their, was it 20s? It would have been 30s. That was like,
teens to 20s, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Were you surprised by how well that book did?
Oh, look, bearing in mind that I wrote that book off the back of having been made redundant as a secretary. I didn't go to university. I didn't do any A-levels. My career trajectory was mainly kind of focused on finding a rich man. I was not intellectual, not literary in any way. And so I wrote this book off the back of a drunken bet with a friend. We were both drunk. It was 4 o'clock in the morning and she made me a bet to write 3 chapters of a novel, which I did. She said that those 3 chapters were so good that I should send them out to some literary agents, which I did. And then one of them wanted to see the rest of the book. So this book only came about, Ralph's Party only came about through this very flimsy, tenuous sort of situation that might not have happened if I hadn't got drunk on a particular night.
Alcohol is good, listener.
Oh, alcohol is good.
We've had that confirmed by an international best-selling author.
Unless you're my child listening, in which case it's very bad. I've never touch it myself, as you well know.
It could make you a millionaire.
Yes.
Anyway, continue.
So this book that was so unlikely that came out of nowhere, and I absolutely thought it was going to flop, or not that even if it was going to flop, I thought everyone at some point was going to say, hold on, we've made a terrible mistake and we have the advance back. This is just nonsense, of course we're not going to publish this. And then they did publish it and it was a huge hit, and not only was it a huge hit, but it was also very well reviewed and very well liked, even in the sort of broadsheets. So the whole thing was just a crazy unexpected fairy tale thing that happened to me, but brilliantly I'm still here 25 years later, which is even more remarkable, I think.
So it sounds like a little bit of imposter syndrome.
I do not have that anymore. I did have it. I had it for a very long time. Most authors have it, but I decided to cast that off.
So was that
a few years ago?
How do you do that? Was that a conscious decision?
It was
not going to do this anymore.
It wasn't fully conscious, but once I realised I was letting go of that, it's nonsense. Obviously, when you've written at that point, you know, 18, 19, 20, whatever books, and people really like them, it's nonsense to go around thinking you don't deserve this or you're not a real writer. So I didn't consciously think, oh, I must get rid of my imposter syndrome, but I just noticed that I was feeling much more confident about what I was doing and much less likely to sort of denigrate myself or put myself down or belittle myself or panic that the next book was going to be a total flop and everyone was going to hate it. And once I realised that's what I was doing, I embraced that. I was like, yeah, that's it. I'm a great writer. I deserve to be here. I've paid my dues. I've written my books. I've given readers what they want. And yeah, I shall be an imposter no more.
And does that make the books easier to write, because I'm trying to write a book now and I'm sitting there going, right, brilliant, here we go, I've got this great idea, here's it, I've got a great joke, here we go, and then I get about half a sentence in and go, oh, I'm terrible at this, I can't do that. Do you still have that, or is that gone now?
I do, but I embrace it, I understand it, I recognise it, I recognise that writing doesn't feel like you're a good writer. When you're writing, it never feels good. And it feels clunky, and it feels like you're finding words to describe things, and you never quite find the right words, and you don't ever feel like you've quite hit the page with what you were intending to hit the page with. But I now know that that doesn't matter, that I'm feeling like that.
God,
I now know it's
relief.
Not supposed to feel all magical and you're in the zone and you're sort of completely possessed by your sort of inner creative. You know, that isn't it. It doesn't feel like that. It feels quite often, to be frank, it feels quite mechanical. It feels like I need a word. Now I need another word. Now I need two or three more words. And then I've got to the end of that sentence. Then I need to start another. So once you've embraced that and realised that that's what it feels like, then you stop worrying that it should feel something different or it should feel better.
Yeah, because in my head it should be like in the films, I should have a typewriter and just sitting there going, chapter three, and then like, ding, next page.
No,
but it's a relief.
No, I honestly type half a sentence and I check my email. Then I type the second half of the sentence and then I check my email. And I type then half a sentence and I check my email.
It's a fucking wonder you've written any books at all, quite
frankly. Well, indeed. But again, this is all part of like owning my processes now, is I don't beat myself up for the fact that I keep breaking off and doing things and I don't ever just sort of get into the flow of it. I just think that's fine, you know, half a sentence, I'll come back and finish it in a minute. And
yeah, because I think the process of beating yourself up just sort of dulls everything, doesn't it? Because I am constantly in that kind of, oh, I'm so carefree, my house is a mess, and I have no sort of lists or anything. And then I think, but yes. I've got to 45.
Exactly.
And I've published a book, and I seem to be doing okay.
That is precisely it. And I live with a man who is, even at the age, he's nearly 60, and he still thinks you can constantly be bettering yourself and improving yourself, and there's always a better way of doing things, and you can always be a better version. And he tries to sort of like, you know, lend me that advice too, and I'm over that now. I'm like, no, look, I'm here, aren't I? Look at me. Everything I've done, every decision I've made, every way I've chosen to live my life has brought me to this place. And look at this place. This is a really good place.
And you're in this place with me. No, I'm with him. I think you can always bet it. I like a course. I like a list.
Oh, no.
I like a plan.
Are you serious?
Yes. Ellie and I, we've been a double act for 11 years. And one of our, I think, our core things is that we are very different.
Yeah.
But we end up, you know, roughly in the same place.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think, I've had a lot of anxiety about not having lists and not doing those things. But then I think it's all right.
Yes.
It's like, okay, and it's a jumble. But I'm the more I'm at peace with it, I actually feel the better I am getting at it, and then I'll eventually get better at things. But
that's
then
precisely.
But
I
do feel, I'm feeling more at peace. Like, I'm in the process of writing a book. We're all writing books, Lisa. Yeah. But I kind of think.
But
no,
does anybody hate you? Does anybody just say, God, I hate that Helen. She's so disorganised. And her house is so messy. She's a bad person. She makes me unhappy.
Not to my face.
No. So you're just.
Just get there eventually.
Exactly, day by day, minute by minute.
Yeah.
No. And in terms of your writing process, do you have like do you get up at 5 a.m? Do you have to have an oak desk and a special pen? Is it all?
I think
that?
You already know how this is going to go.
She gets her arm and sweeps across the kitchen table.
Yes.
There's a box.
Literally. Yeah.
See, I know.
I would say, as much as I'm not particularly fussed about plans and self-improvement and what have you, I do like a solid routine.
Mm.
I love routine. That's the only thing that I'm really sort of quite fussy about. I find it really hard to write when I'm not in a routine, when I'm sort of here, there and everywhere. And I write in the afternoons, which is precisely why we're sitting here in the morning, because then I know that means that I can go home and sort of get back into my routine. So, my writing process very much is dictated by where I am in my schedule in terms of publishing and whether I've got enough time in the day to dedicate to it. But in a dream scenario where I've got an empty week in my diary and I haven't got to go anywhere or do anything, I spend the morning at my kitchen table,
mm-hmm.
having cleared it off. Yes, we've got all the cat hair off.
Oh my god, it's like you're describing my life, Lisa.
I just have a roll of sticky tape, which I reverse round and just pat myself. Yeah, exactly. Oh, I'm going to vomit. I'm going to vomit.
Do you not approve of cats on tables?
I don't approve of cats, mate.
Oh! Oh, okay. Yeah. Gosh, you two are so different, aren't you?
No, that's how it works.
And then I spend the entire morning... Well, first of all, I do all my social media because I'm a big believer if you're... going to put yourself on social media, you need to interact with people who interact with you on social media. So I dedicate at least 2 hours every morning to, when I say being on social media, I don't mean posting pretty pictures, I mean like talking to people.
Yeah, wonderful.
Who've contacted me, and then I do my emails, and then I walk the dog, and this is the only exercise I do. I don't do any other, I have no other way of keeping fit apart from walking the dog, so I make it work. And we usually go out for about an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours, and I try and walk up as many hills as I can. Then I come back and then I start writing at the same spot at the kitchen table. So the goal every day is to write 1,000 words, and if I've written 1,000 words, then I can watch Maths. So that's my sort of...
Oh, we do have something in common. I now Maths. Switch to Ellie. I'm halfway through the latest Australian season.
I'm up to date. I'm having to wait for them to drop now, which is just, I've never had
it's
to wait.
It's too close to me because I'm an Aussie. I'm like, I can't go.
Oh, you'd
I
love it.
I know.
Love it.
Oh.
Why is the Aussie one the best one?
But I don't know. Is it because they're a bit... madder or just a bit more open? They're not
I think they're
uptight
very open.
As English people.
Is it a hark back to Neighbours in the 90s? Are you craving the accent? Is it
mate, no. I don't think anyone in Neighbours decided to get revenge on their cheating girlfriend by having having it off with their friend and making the girlfriend watch.
That's what literally
it's
happened.
It's next level shit, mate.
This is the nicest man in the experiment this year as well. Yeah. It was just like,
and I was watching that thing, I feel like if you put that in one of your books, that people would believe it.
I know.
Right.
Absolutely dark as hell. Just
I'm never
going to
get my
dark.
Book written now, guys. What have you done to me?
To
I've got a lot to catch up on.
No, but I love that's your reward.
That's my carrot. That's my carrot. Yeah. And so sometimes I'll be watching Maths at 6 if I've had a good day, and sometimes I won't be watching Maths till 7:30 if it's taken me a long time to get my 1,000 words. Excellent. 1,000 words down, but yeah, that's how it works.
That's better than smoking, honestly. That sounds like a better option.
Yes,
I mean morally,
I
I'm not sure, but yes, physically,
kind of dirty.
You do feel a bit grubby after, don't you? In a good way, like when you've had sex with someone you don't really like, but it's really good. Sorry, that's too much, isn't it? That's a step
we've
too far.
We've all done it, Ellie. We've all done it. Yes.
But another thing we have in common is a love of Marie Kondo.
No, I think you may have taken something that you've seen and blown it out of proportion to what it was.
No, you've done a Marie Kondo on your books.
I did. I absolutely. So we had to move out of we've got a big four-story house, and it was absolutely full. And we had to empty the whole... I single-handedly emptied the whole house out in order to have it renovated while we moved out. And then so when we moved back in, I deliberately asked for fewer bookshelves because I just thought I can't do this book thing anymore. It's taking over my life. And so I had to make those decisions about the books, which ones were going to go. And I just did that Marie Kondo thing. I picked up each book. I looked at it and I thought, what does this book do for me in my heart? What does it do for me? Did I read it somewhere that I have a strong emotional memory about? Or, you know, did it move me or change me? Is it a book that I'd like to pass on to one of my children one day? And so that's how I made the decision. I did that Marie Kondo sort of sparking joy thing. Yeah. But I have definitely not done that with anything else in my house. I can assure you, I don't, nothing is rolled up into neat little sausages and put into one of those little storage boxes. And no, there's nothing.
You don't
like
have
that.
An alphabetized spine? Straw by any chance later.
No, okay, no. I would love to bring you to my house and show you inside my cupboards.
We should do it like an Instagram live and I'll show you my mess and you show me yours.
Because I love Marie Kondo so much, I was asked to go on BBC's Fool's Good Read. And I was like, I should pick something like E.M. Forster or something really worthy. And I was like, I'm just going to pick Marie Kondo because it's easy to take the piss out of and talk about. And it was,
But do you roll your pants into sausages?
I do, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
She's amazing.
I love it.
And this is really sad. And this is where people are going to turn off or vomit. But I find it relaxed because I put a podcast on. So it's boring. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, it's boring. But I find there's something really satisfying and therapeutic about, or sometimes I watch Maths, actually, having something sort of... Minus or Dirty, maybe a true crime podcast,
yeah.
and just neatly folding your pants
yeah.
and putting them in a little sushi yeah. roll and yeah. putting them in the drawer while you're listening to a story about a cheerleader having her head chopped off. It's just really wholesome and lovely, I find. Just really fills my day with joy.
Do you do it to your children's pants as well?
I do, yeah.
And
yeah.
And do they, how do they?
They couldn't give a shit.
Right, okay.
Yeah, they wouldn't notice. Right. Sometimes right. if I'm like away on tour with Helen, my husband will just chuck them in there. Drawer, and the kids obviously don't care.
Right.
But yeah, but what, why I think I'm not completely mad yeah. is because I don't care. Do you know what I mean? I don't come home and go, oh my God, you yes. haven't rolled up all the pants into sausages. It yeah. doesn't make me, I don't wake up in the night thinking about it. It doesn't make me cross or anxious.
Right, okay.
You don't get the ick. So you don't get yeah. the, yeah.
So I'm mad, but not in a completely life-controlling way.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm going with.
See, I just think it's some people are just so much better at making time count. And I'm terrible at making time count. I just let time run away. It slips through my fingers. Whole hours and days disappear when I don't do anything functional or useful or productive. And then I know people, and some of my favourite people are like you, who just manage to fit so much more into their lives with the same amount of time.
Or into their pants drawer by rolling them or up. Into,
no, but exactly, yeah. exactly. It's just time management is, not my strong suit.
Well, it's hard to know where the time goes, isn't it? Was it 38 episodes, maths, each one an hour?
Yeah, I know.
Where does the time go?
It's hard to know.
I'm glad you brought up the crime thing, Ellie, because I am fascinated by you talking about how you have such a strong stomach for like violence and crime. And then I also read that if someone hurts a dog, no go.
Oh, well, that's quite commonplace. There's even a website called Does the Dog Die that you can consult before you read a book and check. And there's a database. And if you start reading a book and it's got an animal in it, you can immediately consult it to check that the dog doesn't.
I fucking love this.
But there's no equivalent for like children or
It's weird, isn't it? No, it's just somebody posted on my Facebook feed over the weekend about an episode of Cold Cases on Channel 4, which they said was they detailed which one it was, and they said it was so upsetting and they're never going to get it out of their mind and they feel damaged from having watched it and the human depravity. And of course I immediately went home and watched it. And I was just it was a terrible. I mean, it's about this family that got slaughtered by a lunatic with a sledgehammer who just beat them into a pulp and left them there just for the fun of it. But absolutely made no impact on me whatsoever.
Yeah.
It didn't, unlike my Facebook friend who's going to be sort of traumatised by it for forever. Mm. So, yeah, no, I do have a very strong stomach for bad things happening to anybody apart from pets.
What is this thing with women and true crime? And I include myself in women. Because as Helen knows, I love a bit of true crime. And I am fascinated by what is wrong with me.
No, it's because there's nothing wrong with you. That's why it's fascinating.
How do you mean?
I don't know. I feel from being myself and also knowing a lot of other writers in my genre, female writers in my genre, and being very aware of the fact that we're all just very, very pleasant, grounded human beings who live very fragrant, normal existences, that's kind of part of it.
Mm.
It's that other, that sort of fascination with the fact that while we're living our little lives and rolling our children's pants into sausages and running the marathon, not me, that's Helen I'm talking about, there are other people who are, chopping heads off cheerleaders, as you say. And it's just that sort of the shock of it and the fascination of it and the extraordinariness of it that I think it is. I don't think there's anything wrong with the people who enjoy watching that stuff. I think it's quite the opposite. I think we're just utterly normal and
but is it that balance between kind of making sense, because sometimes when life is going well, you're like, but what could happen? Like,
oh, absolutely. We're all
our way of sort of
Every morning, and every single one of us, regardless of what sort of human being we are, is walking like next to this invisible line.
Yeah.
And on the other side of that invisible line, your life just is destroyed.
Yeah.
And it could happen at any moment, and you don't know what it is, and you don't know, it might be letting the wrong person into your life, or turning down the wrong road, or letting your child go into the wrong person's house, or just tiny little decisions you make. and you could just introduce something into your life that just destroys it.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I think it's that sort of, you know, knowing that secretly, even though we're all just sort of distracting ourselves with this sort of, you know, banal minutiae of just getting on with our lives.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that makes, because the ones I really like, I really like things that happen in like small town America, like high school murders and like people, like parents who kill their children or children who kill their parents. Oh my God! Because I love that sort of horrific thing in a mundane setting. I find that more interesting than an absolute lunatic who drove a lorry and killed 20 people. Do you know what I mean? That's not.
Well, they're
not
all fun. Quite interesting. Really, as you may have noticed from reading None of This Is True, I'm actually also fascinated in the non-crime based, not the non-crime, the non-murderous,
right,
dark side, you know, the Tinder swindlers what was that woman called from Eastern Europe who went to New York and they made Anna, what's her name?
Yes.
I've seen that, like Inventing Anna.
Anna, and things like that as well. I think those are the ones I really, really enjoy. It's not necessarily about grisly murders. It's just about people who manage to manipulate other people into doing the most extraordinary things and believing the most ridiculous, farcical things, lies. And making people behave in ways that those people didn't know they were capable of behaving in. I find those sorts of things absolutely fascinating.
Have you heard the Scamander?
Oh my goodness.
So good.
Honestly. And I do know a true life Scamander, but we're not going to talk about that.
Well, let's talk about your book instead. Your None of This Is True. So, yeah, so you switched from romantic comedy to thrillers.
I gradually evolved.
And the latest one, None of This Is True, I mean, as I've read loads and loads of your books and loads of your thrillers, and honestly this is my favourite one, maybe partly because it didn't resonate with me because it's about a podcaster who's also on Instagram, and there's a bit of Twitch in there, and but apart from all that, it's not just that it's about me, it's what I love about this one, but also actually all of your thrillers, is that, to be honest, I read a lot of thrillers and quite often I can work out who did it. I'll be like, oh yeah, no, it's the brother, by about page 110. But I with this one, I was just constantly right up to the end, right up to the last page. And that is a real skill. Like, how do you do that, Lisa?
Because I wanted to do it. I think that was, I had a goal with this one, which is I wanted to, because I write without a plan, so I don't know what's going to happen until I've written it, but that also translates into the experience for the reader as well. I just wanted to feel uncomfortable the entire time, and I wanted the reader to feel uncomfortable the entire time, and I wanted everything to be so uncertain and slippery and weird and dark, and for these secrets to just keep unpeeling and unpeeling and unpeeling. But at the same time, as you're listening to this woman, the subject of the podcast interview, revealing her truth, you also know that, well, the title is kind of a giveaway, None of This Is True, that a lot of it isn't true. So yes, I just wanted the reader to feel wrong-footed, uncertain the entire time. So even if something wasn't happening, even if I didn't have to like keep feeding drama into it for the reader to feel like that, because the whole setup is so precarious and weird. So that was kind of a very much a deliberate goal with this. I wanted it to feel like one of those weird Netflix documentaries. That was what I wanted it to feel like. So yeah, that's why you felt like that while you're reading it.
Well, thanks for that. Thank you for making me deeply uncomfortable for hours and hours. I loved it.
And she's really creepy as well. I love writing creepy people. I love writing creepy people as well. And Josie is superlatively creepy.
Yeah. But also your characters are not flat, are they? Often there's creepy people. They do a creepy thing.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily the whole story or the whole
So, for example, you know, we're talking about dogs as we just were. Yeah, Josie is on one hand behaving hideously and abusively almost, but on the other hand you see her being incredibly tender with her little dog and being very, very sort of, you know, mindful of his welfare, and being very loving with him. So yes, it's very important to me that I hate the sort of idea of just a black and white kind of baddie villain of the piece situation, because it's just, unless you're talking about a true psychopath, people generally are just sort of victims of their own upbringings and their own trauma, and they've all got their own story. And there's nuance and there's shades, so, which is something I always like to, It makes it more fun to write a character like that as well. It'd be really boring to write a character who's just one note evil. Mm. You know, I like to bring all that to it.
Yeah, because I am fascinated with the fact that you may not know who is the murderer, and that must be exciting as a writer as well, because you're sort of on your own, choose your adventure through the whole thing.
Not
just sort of plotted out, going, well, I'm just going to get to the finishing line. Like you're on that sort of exciting adventure as well, and I think often we think that writers know everything from the get-go,
like godlike sort of overlord of everything, and
you've got a big whiteboard with like all the darts of going, no, but then that's going to happen, but it's nice to hear you just trust the process now.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And that was part of what we were talking about earlier about imposter syndrome, and part of sort of coming to terms with how I write and how I live and who I am, and you know, how it all works. And absolutely, that's part of it. It's such a cliche trust process, but I have to, because it is my process. And I had the few years in the middle of my career, and I just thought maybe this would be easier if I did start writing chapter plans or making notes or having some sort of idea of what I was going to write before I wrote it. And I bought a notepad and I opened it and I wrote chapter plan. And then a few years later, I felt the same way as I was starting, but I should write a chapter plan for this one. And I opened a drawer and I found a notepad and I opened it and I took it out and I opened it and it was that one. And it just literally was an empty page with chapter plan written on it. And that, I think for me, that was a wake up call. It's like, okay, that didn't work then, probably not going to work now. Let's just forget about doing chapter plans and just carry on doing it the way you're doing it, but with confidence and, you know, I love what you said, choose your own adventure. That is genuinely what it feels like. And I do sometimes, you know, I get towards the end of writing a chapter, which is exactly where I'm at the moment. When I leave you today, I'm going back to finish a chapter that I started on Friday. And it's got three possible ways it could go. And I spent the entire weekend sort of thinking, which way shall I go? I still don't know. But I know I've got to sit on my computer when I get home and decide which way the end of that chapter will go, which will completely inform the rest of the journey for that character and that storyline. But I probably will just decide as I sit down and just think, okay,
That's exciting. That's the joy of it as well. Like you're discovering it as you go along.
Yes, and I do think that's what gives it a lot of the energy that readers really relate to and readers really feel. Just like I have a lot of readers who have come to me with like some of my more recent books and then have gone back through my backlist, which I find really gratifying, because they feel a certain way when they're reading my books. And even though all my books are really different, they still feel the same way reading them, regardless of what sort of genre they're in, because I do think it's because of that energy that's inherent in my books, because I'm sort of experiencing it the same way that the reader is experiencing it, because I want to know what happens next.
Is that why you write in the present tense then, because you're sort of seeing the story unfold?
That's all. I think I started all my romantic comedies and my family dramas were in the past tense. And I think it's something I started doing subconsciously when I moved across into writing thrillers, particularly when I'm writing in the first person. Every now and then I'll choose a character to write in the first person, because mainly they're the ones with the really interesting psyches that I really want to get into. And that's a very immediate way for me to get into a character's head, is to write them in the first person. It's just evolved into me always writing in the present tense now.
I was going to say, as a mother of teens, has parenting informed some of the ways that you approach your work? Like, I heard you on Daisy Buchanan's podcast, and I loved how you were describing your teens that changed every 6 months.
Yes.
And, you know, and she's like, because I've got a 15-year-old who refused to wear makeup.
Yeah.
And now we're doing makeup, we're doing eyelash curling before school. And But screamed in my face 6 months ago saying, I'm never wearing makeup.
Exactly.
No, I'm only wearing trousers. And I was like, okay. And I just sort of held lightly. I'm like, okay, we're not going to define you right this minute. We're just going to kind of see where it goes. And it sort of really struck a chord with me, because I think teens are so adamant of who they are right now.
Yes.
And that's it. And she's always saying, I know more than you. I've seen everything. You know, the world has come to her rather than you go to the world, which we had to do. We had to go interrailing and all that sort of stuff. But the world has come to them. So they see it so differently. And it's hard to not scream back in their faces.
I do know more than you. I learned it in a book. I didn't learn it on TikTok.
But yeah, sorry, that's a really randomly scrambled thing. But
it's a very interesting observation.
Yeah. But I just thought it was interesting how you described your parenting and also the way you, with writing as well, that you've just sort of let it flow.
Yes.
And not let it overwhelm you.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No, I do. I think I do take a very similar approach to parenting as I take to writing, in as much as trusting my own instincts and not overthinking, and I've had to reprogram my husband as well when it comes to parenting, because he was very much some adults forget what it was like to be a teenager.
Yeah.
And he's one of those adults who's forgotten what it was like to be a teenager, whereas I did. The minute my children came into their teenage years, I had this immediate reconnection, really profound reconnection with my teenage self. And I absolutely remembered everything. I was there. So I could face them as teenagers, feeling very closely connected to my own teenage self. And remembering the things that my parents did that really helped me when I was a teenager, particularly my mother. Whereas my husband very much still stood back here of just like, I am a grown man and I know what's wrong and I know what works and what doesn't and what decisions are bad and which decisions are good and how things should work. And I'm going to pronounce, and that's and you should take my advice on all matters because I've made all these mistakes. Listen, no, you've got to let them make their own mistakes. You've got to say, look, if you do that, X, Y, Z could happen, but you do you. You go and do that, and then if X, Y, and Z happens, then you'll have had that experience and you'll know what I'm talking about, rather than don't do that because X, Y, and Z will happen. So, yes, I've had to reprogram. He's great now. He's
good.
Yeah, he's really
so you were parenting three children at
this stage. But particularly with teenage girls as well, because, you know, I was a teenage girl. I had two sisters. He was a teenage boy and he had a brother. So it was kind of a whole new...
Yeah,
a whole new thing for him, and we just live in this very peaceable household where nobody really shouts at anybody else, and it's just sort of
that's a nice place to be.
Yeah, it's a really nice place to be, particularly compared to the sort of like tween years. God, you're in the tween years, aren't you?
Yeah,
they're hard.
I don't know. I'm finding it all right, but that probably means I'm going to have an absolutely dreadful teenage experience.
I think a teenage experience is what the parent makes it, though. I really do.
Yeah,
I think you can make it a nightmare if you choose to. I think that's basically what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So what's your advice? Just to kind of just let them free. If they love you, they'll come back.
I'm sitting here from the vantage point of someone who has been very, very liberal with her teenage children and let them do whatever they want and been incredibly lovely to them and supportive, and nothing bad has happened to them, and possibly things could, you know, talking about that invisible line, possibly things could have gone wrong at certain junctures because I've given them so much freedom to make mistakes and learn their own lessons. But nothing has gone wrong. So I would very much...
And they're good at talking to you. I think one of the things that we hear from parents is that it's when teenagers shut off.
Exactly.
And then there's the betrayal, there's the silence, there's all those sort of things. And then the conflict starts because, like, why won't you tell me? And why are you doing the things I want you to do?
Why are you lying to
me?
And then
it's the analogy of the two shields, you know, like you're not doing what I want and you don't love me for who I am, all those sort of things. But it's always a hard balance because you're like, I want to give you the rope.
Yeah.
I want to give you the rope, but you know, how much, what are you going to do with it?
But I also want you to stay safe and for nothing bad to happen to you.
Yeah.
And nobody to hurt you and all of those things.
All that. And that's that. But look, I think there's so much... So many great things about teenagers. Like,
I love them so much.
And they can really, they're great company. And I do like seeing the world through their eyes.
Yes.
Like, it's a confusing world. Like, I have no idea what they're saying half the time. They're speaking in a whole new language.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know. They are talking in a whole new language. And they do this thing where they, instead of like having a phone call, they'll send each other voice messages.
That's maddening.
And then they listen to them on the speed up thing.
Yeah.
So they can listen to the messages really quickly. So you've got these sort of like messages, and then they'll record one, and then another one will come back, and the whole thing is just
dizzying.
Why are you
talking on the phone?
Yeah.
It's like the Pontypines are back. Yeah. We've done all that bit.
Yeah, but it's just phases, isn't it? I had a WhatsApp last night from my friend Keza, who we actually have a bit about Keza in her show because she's a bit younger than me, and she I had my kids first, and she, I remember her. We had a conversation when she was pregnant with her first one, and she said, "Oh, do you know?" And she's super clever, right? She speaks like Japanese and German and all these languages. She said, "When I'm on maternity leave, I'm going to have so much spare time, you know, while the baby sleeps. I think I'm going to learn Mandarin." Which literally became a joke in our show. And then she came to see the show and I was like, there she is. And she's like, fair. She's not learned Mandarin.
Right, not when the baby sleeps.
I know.
I love the idea.
But she sent me a message last night saying, you won't remember this, but a few years ago, because her boys are quite young, she's like, you said to me, there will come a point where you can sit in a pub and have a meal and a conversation with the big one while the little one just colours something in and actually talk to your husband and your older child, and it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And that happened today, and I can't believe it. And I was like, oh, mate. But it may, because you forget, don't you, how tricky that bit is. And then I've had this new thing this weekend where my 12-year-old is now going out of his mates, right? So he's going bowling or to cinema, you know, not nightclubbing or anything.
Yeah.
People say nightclubbing anymore? Probably not.
Only us.
He went to the local disco. He went to the night spot. Preachers. And so he goes out, and then it's just me and my husband and the 9-year-old, and it's like having an only child. And obviously we love and miss the older one, but it's also like...
Oh, it's lovely.
It's really nice, and it alleviates sort of guilt of... You know, the big son had us for 3 years on his own before the little one. And and it just made me think, oh, you know, I want to just say to people, and say to Keza specifically, like, it's going to, it does.
Oh, it just does get better and better and better, I think. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And it is all phases. And I just don't miss anything. I think the only thing I'm going to miss when they're gone, assuming they go, I've said they can stay till they're 30.
That's what Ellie says. They can stay
till they're 30. It's fine. My husband didn't leave home till he was 31, so he's not got a leg to stand on in that department. I can't remember what I was going to say.
No, things
when
you
they
miss.
Leave.
Oh, this will be the bit I miss. This will be having teenagers in the house and all their friends and the sort of I already miss this, but every other phase, once it's gone, I'm just over it, finished, excellent, let's move on.
Yeah, there was a woman on the train last night with a screaming baby.
Oh, Lord.
And you could see that the child very much wanted milk, you know, doing that, you know, and so she had to find a place to sit down and breastfeed, and everyone was getting stressed, and I thought, I have been that mother, sweat, and, worried about the baby, but then worried about everybody else, and, like, you just... Motherhood has become incredibly public. Like, your choices that you make, what the children wear, all those sort of things. Like, that, it's so much more pressurized than it was, you know, even like 10, 15 years ago. I don't miss that toddler. And when we started doing the podcast, I remember being on the bus and my kid had a massive meltdown. I was like, Matilda! And then someone went, oh, I recognize your voice for the podcast. Oh, that's so funny. I was like, shit.
Darling. That's right. Express yourself.
So funny. Mummy won't say no. Yes, she will when you go home. Awful.
So was it hard when the big one went off to uni? Was
not at all, because we still had the little one. You were just saying about your night alone with your 9-year-old, I love just having the little one at home, because I've never just had the little one. I've not had that time with her. And we've become so much closer, and we've really learned how to sort of rock along together, and we just really found our little groove with each other. And of course, the big one comes home all the time because of university holidays being so frequent and so long. I have not missed it. Do not know how I'll feel when the little one and the big one are gone. That might be a bit of a wrench, but... I don't know.
Yeah, they don't leave you. And I think someone said about, you know, children, they become closer and closer.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
I felt like I needed my mum much more when I hit my 20s and when I had my babies. I was like, mum, I've done this. You know, there'll be times where that sort of, it's those waves, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yes, yes, which is what I'm imagining.
Yeah.
That's what the future will look like. If they go, they'll still be huge. And I think living in London as well is really helpful, because it means that they don't have to, like, schlep halfway across the country.
No, you've made it too nice for them later.
Yeah, they can just get on the tube to come see us or whatever, so it should be like, there should still be a huge part of our lives. I hope so.
And do they read your books?
No.
Yeah, our kids couldn't give a shit about what we're doing.
Mine read.
Can I read you something funny, actually? Are either of you watching baby reindeer?
No, I've heard that's meant to
be amazing.
So my daughter sent me this message last night on WhatsApp. She said, have you watched Baby Reindeer? I said, no, not yet. I'm desperate to start. Have you? Yeah, it's mental, like very stressful. Defo do not want a stalker. I'm on episode 4 and it just gets worse and worse. It's like a book you would write.
Awesome.
I said, I'll take that as a compliment. She said, yes, although I hope you're not quite mentally disturbed enough to write that. Although Alex, who's her housemate, said none of this is true, was very disturbing and twisted and is concerned about how you came up with it. So, yeah, her housemate's read my book. But, yeah, she's read the book. But my children have not read my book. But now maybe she might be tempted after watching Baby Reindeer. I don't know. But, no, they haven't. My husband listens to my books every year on audio by the pool. But he doesn't read any other books, so just does that every year. So
And just going back to writing, any tips for writers? Any advice after all these years of best-selling novels?
I do think that a lot of people kind of give themselves obstacles to writing, which are of their own making, and I think if you can just try and get rid of those obstacles, it's almost like giving yourself permission, because it can sometimes feel quite audacious or overwhelming as well to start writing. And I think if you just shrink it down in your head and not overthink it and not like place it in too big of a room. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. Because I think some people then look at the market and they think, oh, nobody would want to read it, or somebody's already written that, or I just think it's very easy to find reasons and ways not to write, and most of those can be stripped back, and ultimately all you need to do is place yourself in front of a laptop with a Word document open and just start typing words in a row and just keep doing that and just keep doing it.
Just fucking do it. Just get on with it.
Just get on with it and don't overthink it and don't put obstacles in your way, because that's how books don't get written, frankly.
Excellent. I'm motivated now.
We're both getting home now and writing our books, Ellie.
Excellent.
Gibson. Yes.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, we do like to end the podcast, Lisa, with a scummy mummy confession. I'll start if you like.
Yes, please.
So my young son, Joe, who is 9, I was just talking about how lovely it is just to have him to ourselves. What a lovely child he is. Oh, it's all jolly, isn't it? So he went back to school after the Easter holidays last week. And he came home and Pete said, oh, how was your day at school, Joe? Did you have fun? And he went, no, it was a day passed to hell. So, what are we letting him watch on YouTube? I don't know. Where's he getting this stuff from?
That's the title of your novel, Ellie.
But yeah, that's my happy, adorable little 9-year-old. A day passed to hell. Okay. Do you want a biscuit? I don't know. Do you have pizza for lunch? So that was jolly. Helen, have you got one for us this week?
Oh, yes. I'm going to be that boring prick who talks about the marathons. So yesterday I ran the London Marathon, and I'd run the Boston Marathon 6 days before, and my muscles were sore, and someone said, take a lot of magnesium. But I didn't know that taking a lot of magnesium, it does help your muscles get less sore, but also is a laxative.
I didn't know that.
No, excess
That's
consumption.
New information.
Yes, exactly right. So I trotted off the marathon feeling very very confident, and had my porridge and my banana. But as I was going around the Cutty Sark,
oh lovely,
I was thinking, I can't trust this fart. I'm not.
A Cutty Shart.
Thank you very much. I lobbed that one, and thank you for slamming it. So I started getting like the meat sweats, and I don't know about you, but have you ever tried to run and clench your bum at the same time? You look silly, and it's quite dangerous.
Ooh.
it was a very
very funny.
I'm clenching now.
I know. So I knew what was coming was coming. And so there was a row of Portaloos coming up past the Greenwich sort of bypass. And but then there was a queue. So I was just going, well, it is what it is. And then I made all the... I'm sure it rocked. I'm sure there was an explosion. So don't have magnesium before a race. That's what I'm saying.
No.
But I had tissues for the first incident. And then the second incident, I had to use my lucky sweatband. Which I've used for every marathon. But I thought, no.
Oh, put it in a bucket of bleach. It'd be fine.
No, you put it in a bin, didn't you?
No, I put it into the loo. Or is that bad?
You flushed it.
I flushed
it. That's worse than anything that came before.
Oh my god, you've just created a new fatberg. You flushed it.
I flushed my lucky sweatband. But it was in the Portaloo, isn't that just... Oh.
Where do you think that goes? I think that goes to a special Portaloo shit swamp. Do you think that's like... Lisa Jewell, what I know, Lisa, you write about people are hacking each other to death.
Up.
You're absolutely horrified.
I used a sweatband to wipe my bum.
No, you flushed it down the toilet.
Kill me!
This is a real horror. What would you have done, Lisa, in that situation?
Number one, you would not have found me running a marathon.
All right. Sort of, yeah. That's the crime.
Yeah. Oh, God, I was about to tell a poo story, but I feel no, I'm not going
to
do
that. All right. See, this is my gift the internet, is I go there
so that others don't have to.
Yeah, you go high, Lisa. Come on.
No, I need to know. I've been like, this is the back of a book. You're on the marathon. You shit yourself. You only have a sweatband. What do you do? All caps. Big question mark. Helen Thorne is a mum of two who thinks she's living a normal life until one fateful day.
She overdosed on supplements.
She overdoses on magnesium and finds herself in a terrible predicament.
She was not in a bind. Why was there no toilet paper?
Because ask the marathon people. I don't know.
Okay.
Yes.
Look, we've all found ourselves in that situation. Or just unpleasant toilet situations. And we've all had to, you know, improvise.
Yeah. Yes. I know. Yeah. It's not. It's
so
not
I could. I was so like, even though you told me you were going to be asking me this question, I did have something lined up, but I feel like I need to match that now somehow. Okay. And it's about poo, but luckily it's not my poo, although it sort of is now my poo.
Oh wow.
This what is a build up.
Many a shitty sweatband in a handbag.
many years
came
ago.
Out of my drain.
Many years ago. Well, number one, this ties in with what I was going to tell you, which was I used to give my children chocolate for breakfast. But I had given my little one, who was a toddler at the time, somewhere between 18 months and 2 years old, a chocolate mousse after her pudding. And then I'd forgotten that I'd given her a chocolate mousse after her pudding. And then about an hour later, I was in the kitchen and she came up to me and held up this hand that had what I thought was chocolate mousse on it.
Oh my.
I'm clenching.
And because I was sort of busy, she wanted me to wipe it off her hands. And because I was busy in the kitchen, I just thought,
you know what it was. She'd had her hand down the back of her nappy.
Yes.
You knew straight away, didn't you?
Oh, yes. So I have eaten my daughter's poo. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. You are not the first. Bryony Gordon, another Sunday Times best-selling writer, did the same.
Oh, did she? Did she think it was chocolate mousse?
Yeah. Yeah. We've had
it in the show.
And raisins that they thought.
Yes. Oh!
The pebble. Yeah. Right. The chocolate covered raisin.
Picked a Malteser off the stairs. Reader, it was not a Malteser. Yes.
Don't worry. You're in good company.
Yeah. As always, we've managed to completely lower the tone, which is a nice way to end the podcast. I love that we're sitting in Penguin's beautiful,
I know,
sort of chrome gleaming office.
It's pristine.
Everything matches.
Yeah. And we're sitting here talking about eating shit. Yeah. What a wonderful world we live in.
It's a wonderful tribute.
It's a wonderful modern world. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having
Lisa.
Me. What fun.
Congratulations on 25 years of Ralph's Party. Is there a new edition then with all the sparkly cover and all
that? Yes, that is in fact why I'm here at Penguin's offices today, because I was asked to read the intro. I had to write an intro for it. and they're doing the audiobook, so I recorded that. And yes, so it's being republished next month in May in a beautiful, modern-looking, sort of Emily Henry-esque style cover to bring it all bang up to date.
Lovely.
Hoodwink a whole new generation of people into reading my earlier books.
Excellent. And None of This Is True is a, honestly, it's a fantastic book. I go through phases sometimes where I don't feel like reading, and then I always know that one of your books will get me back in, because they're such good page turners. I know I'll pick it up and get to the end in about 24 hours.
Excellent.
I feel like, yes, I can read. I can remember how to do this.
Social media hasn't destroyed my brain or my concentration. Yes.
Yes. So I'd really recommend it for that. I don't know if you're allowed to say, but I know you wrote a sequel to The Family Upstairs, which is another brilliant book. Are you going to do a sequel to this one?
No, but I have been in talks with my publishers about writing a bonus chapter, which will go out there'll be a promotion for the ebook of this later on in the year, and I'll write a bonus chapter for it, which will hopefully move the story on a little bit for all those unanswered questions that people might have.
Oh, so many.
But there definitely won't be a sequel. There definitely won't be a sequel.
Yes, well, we're on tour, Helen.
We are. We're up and down the country. We're booked until the end of the year, and then more shows in 2025 as well. But where are we going in May, Ellie?
Good question, Helen. Very good question. Are we going to Leicester?
We're going to Leicester. We're going to Wales, apparently. Oxford.
We're back to Hartford in October, which I'm very, very excited about.
Mansfield, Liverpool, Nottingham, Exeter, Redruth. And then, Newbury, Watford, York, Birmingham, Sevenoaks, and then a little rest in the summer.
Yes, exactly and right. And then we'll be at the big festival, which was very exciting.
Yes.
I love Alex James's cheese.
Who doesn't? Well, thank you again for coming on the podcast, Lisa. It's been so lovely to have you and to meet you. I've had a lovely time.
It's been a joy. Thank you very
much. Thank you for having me. It's been super.
Wonderful.
Until next time.
Bye-bye. Bye.
It's great. Flushing a sweatband down the toilet versus eating shit. I mean, again, who's the real villain here?
of all the elements of that story, I didn't think the flushing of the sweatband was...
That was what gave me cause to do an intake of breath.
Oh. That's up there with Jaden in maths and it's weird.
Yes.
Thing.
Sex punishments. Yes.
I have been told...